I'm going to be speaking for about 25 minutes, and then I suppose afterwards there'll be time for questions, which I imagine the chair is going to moderate. So let's begin. Public discourse today is dominated by commercial social media platforms such as Facebook and Twitter, as well as a plethora of smaller walled gardens that individual media companies such as online newspapers and magazines provide for the discussion of their published content. Not only do these companies own and operate the discussion venues, but they also use this centralized ownership to control, or at least to exert an overwhelming guiding influence on who participates, on what is discussed, and on what viewpoints are expressed. These companies, moreover, ruthlessly exploit their users for commercial gain. But the internet was not always like this. In the 1980s and 1990s, most online conversations took place on Usenet, a worldwide discussion network that was open to everyone and had no centralized structure, ownership, or control. Usenet was largely operated by and in the interests of its users, many of whom were openly hostile to the idea of commercial influence. Far from being an anarchic Wild West, Usenet succeeded in coalescing its millions of diverse users into a functional, thriving online society, which was united through shared culture, conventions, and values. So in this talk, I want to compare and contrast these two models of online discussion and to discuss the developments that led to the free access public good of Usenet being supplanted by privately owned discussion venues. I also want to talk about the consequences of this transformation and what these lessons can teach societies of the future, both online and in the real world. So just so that we can remind ourselves, let's run through how social media works today from the user's perspective. And let me also add a few comments on what's going on behind the scenes from a technical and economic perspective. Now, to participate in a discussion on social media today, you first need to decide which social media platform you're going to use. So the major general purpose ones today include Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. Though as the latter two are concerned primarily with images and short videos, which are a bit less conducive to protracted discussion, I'll use Facebook as my primary example. So the next thing you need to do, if you haven't already done so, is to sign up for an account on one of these services. Now, for Facebook, this is a rather simple matter of filling out a short form with your real name, your contact details, and your birth date, and then reading through and agreeing to a 130-page, 45,000-word legal contract governing your use of the service and signing over many of your rights and freedoms to Facebook. And if you don't believe me, here is a PDF that I produced by copying and pasting all the terms and conditions from the Facebook website into an A4 paper-sized document, and I increased the small print up to a 12-point font so that we can read it. And as you can see, there's quite a lot of material in here that you're agreeing to. I'm not really sure, probably most of us here have Facebook accounts. I'm not all that sure that any of us have taken the time to read through exactly what it is we were agreeing to when we signed up. And I imagine doing so, well, it's not quite 130 pages because I've also copied in a lot of boilerplate text, but it's definitely more than 100. Now, of course, most users probably do skip through the reading through the contract part, but that doesn't make the contract any less enforceable by Facebook. Now, after creating an account, you can go ahead and log into the system. And normally you do this by visiting the platform's web application in your computer's web browser or through a standalone app that you download and install on your mobile device. Either way, this interface or client is generally the only officially permitted way of interacting with the social media platform. If you don't use the company's official client, then you can't use the service at all. And because the source code for these apps is not made public, it can be difficult or impossible, even for a technically skilled user, to verify that the app isn't unduly violating your personal privacy or the security of your computer or mobile device. It's also not possible for the user to modify the app to, say, improve or change its functionality. Now, the first time you log into a new account, most social media platforms will encourage you to provide them with a list of your interests, ostensibly so that they can match you with content or discussion areas that you might like. The platform will also expose a search function to you that you can use for the same purpose by entering keywords. Now, in addition to existing content providers and discussion areas, the platform will automatically create one for your own personal discussion area that you can manage yourself. And you can post your own messages to this area and perhaps allow certain others or the public at large to do so as well. The platform might also allow you to create additional named discussion groups and also to control who can read or post to those groups. Now, when you post a message to Facebook, what happens is that it gets sent from your device to a central server that is owned and operated by Facebook. And this is where the message remains. There is only one primary persistent copy of the message, and its canonical home is Facebook HQ. Your own device doesn't keep a copy of the message, though of course you can visit Facebook at any point in the future to view it, as can any of your friends or members of the public who you have told Facebook have permission to see it also. Now, the fact that Facebook has a virtual monopoly on the storage of this message, combined with the fact that you've signed over many of your rights to it, means that Facebook is generally free to package, modify, and redistribute your message as it sees fit. And most of the time, that means advertising. Facebook analyzes the content of your message, along with the personal information that you already provided to the service, in order to determine what sort of products and services you and the potential readers of your message would be most receptive to buying. So when Facebook displays your messages to other users, or when it decides what other users' messages to display to you, it will intersperse those messages with personally targeted ads from its customers. And note my terminology here. You may be one of Facebook's users, but you are not one of its customers. Facebook's customers are the companies that buy ad space on its service. And it is these customers, not the users, to which Facebook's own interests are beholden. And what this means is that the entire user experience on Facebook is geared not towards fostering productive public discussion and debate, but rather to get you to visit Facebook for as often and for as long as possible to maximize your exposure to its customers' advertisements. There is a huge number of mechanisms that Facebook uses to achieve this goal. So let me just give three quick examples. So first, longer and potentially more thoughtful posts are always truncated after a few lines, with the remainder hidden behind a See More link that needs to be manually activated. This encourages users to scroll past these longer messages to get to the next bit of content, which more often than not is an ad. And of course, it's only the posts and never the ads which get hidden behind these See More links. This truncation behavior also has the effect of encouraging users to write shorter, punchier contributions rather than carefully reasoned arguments. Second, there is the matter of Facebook's choice of what messages to show in your own personal newsfeed. This is never a full chronological list of posts from the people and groups that you've subscribed to. Rather, it is an algorithmically curated selection of what Facebook thinks you would find the most interesting. Presenting material from a diversity of viewpoints is not a goal of the system. And so the overall effect is to put users in echo chambers where they hear little more than their own opinions and viewpoints reflected back at them. And third, there's the relatively recent phenomenon of stories, which are a special kind of user post that gets automatically deleted after 24 hours. Facebook goes out of its way to promote these posts on your newsfeed, and its app encourages you to create them yourself. But users themselves were not the driving force behind the creation of the stories feature. Nobody had been clamoring for time-limited self-destructing messages. Rather, the whole point of this feature is to get people into the habit of visiting Facebook at least once per day, so as not to miss out on this artificially ephemeral content. And of course, more frequent visits to Facebook means more eyeballs on the advertisements. So let's compare this to how people conducted discussions online 20 or 30 or 40 years ago, before the advent of Facebook and similar social media sites. Now, keep in mind that Although the internet has been gradually built up since the late 1960s, what most people think of as the internet today is really only one very recent part of it, the World Wide Web. The web is a hypertext-based information system upon which today's social media platforms are based. But this system was invented only in 1989, and it was opened up to the public use only in 1991, and didn't really take off in a big way until the late 1990s. So how did people meet and talk publicly online before the web became popular, or indeed before it even existed? Well, the simplest answer to this question is Usenet, also known as network news, net news, or even just news. Usenet is a computerized communication network that was established in 1980 as a means of propagating public announcements and discussions. It quickly attracted a user base in the millions, and by 1984, it was estimated to account for 85% of all network traffic at participating computing sites. These sites included about 1,000 universities, research labs, and companies all around the world. At its peak in the late 1990s, Usenet was seeing about 20,000 users post about 300,000 new messages every day, resulting in about 2 gigabytes of new text every day. As you can see here, Usenet's content has a hierarchical structure that somewhat resembles a modern web-based communication forum. The discussion groups, known as news groups, are organized into a tree-like naming system with hundreds of top-level hierarchies. So for example, in the comp hierarchy, you would find discussions about computing topics. The sci hierarchy is for discussions about the sciences. Soc is for social sciences, and so on. Each hierarchy is further subdivided until terminating at the actual news groups. So for example, the news groups are actually referred to by the full path from the top level down to the bottom level. So for example, there is the news group here, which is called soc.history.ancient, which, as the name suggests, is for discussing ancient history. And also not pictured here would be another news group called soc.history.medieval for discussing medieval history, and so on. Each news group contains articles, which are the individual messages that are contributed by users. Each article is submitted to one or more news groups according to the topic of the article, and any article can be responded to, making chains of messages called threads. Now, aside from the strange naming convention for news groups, none of this should be too surprising or difficult to understand for users of modern day web forums or even social media, which also have thread-like structures. But under the hood, Usenet is quite different from these modern forums. Unlike Facebook and Twitter and other web-based discussion systems, Usenet has a decentralized network architecture where the responsibility for gathering, storing, and distributing messages is spread across a vast federation of independently owned and operated servers. When a user posts an article to one Usenet server from their Usenet client, the server stores that message, but also forwards a copy to all of its neighboring servers. And this process repeats itself until the article has been propagated to every server in the entire Usenet network. In the early 1980s, this process could sometimes take several days. But with advances in networking infrastructure, the lag time was gradually reduced to hours, and then to minutes, and then even to seconds. Each server makes the articles that it has received available for reading to its own news users, and will also send out any replies that they post to the rest of the network. Now, a great advantage of this architecture is its resilience, both to failure and to censorship. Because every server in the network receives a copy of every message, the loss of any one server does not result in the loss of any data. If one Usenet server goes down, either temporarily or permanently, then all the messages posted to it remain available from any other server in the network. By contrast, when Facebook or Twitter temporarily goes down, nobody can read any of the posts there. And if either of those companies were to go out of business altogether, their entire archives of messages could be irretrievably lost forever. For the same reasons, there is no effective way to censor or delete a posting to Usenet. Once a message has gone out, it persists in thousands of copies all over the world almost instantaneously. Should Facebook or Twitter object to one of your social media posts, however, they can delete it at their pleasure. And unless you happen to keep a separate copy of it for yourself, it's gone forever. So how did the system actually work from the user's perspective? If you were an ordinary internet user in the 1980s or 1990s, how did you get onto Usenet and start using it? Well, unlike with Facebook and Twitter, there was generally no formal sign-up process. Chances are, whatever connection you normally use to get onto the internet, whether that was through your school or your employer, or maybe your home dial-up or broadband internet provider, would be running its own Usenet server as part of its normal internet service. But even if they didn't, there were many free public access Usenet servers that you could connect to, many of which were operated by private individuals. There were even a few commercial Usenet servers offering paid subscriptions. The terms of service contracts ranged from very brief to non-existent, and in any event, were not crafted to commodify your messages for the benefit of the service provider. To set up your computer for use with Usenet, you'd need to install something known as a news client or newsreader, which operated in much the same way as an email program does. Unlike today's Facebook and Twitter, where you were obliged to use the company's official client, there were dozens of news clients to choose from, many of which were available free of charge. Home ISPs often bundled a newsreader with the software delivered to new customers, but you could always download and install a different one. Users often tried out several different newsreaders before settling on one that met their own particular needs and preferences. And many of these newsreaders also included the complete access to the source code. So if you knew how to program, you could make further adaptations and customizations yourself. Upon starting up the newsreader for the first time, you'd simply provide your name, email address, and the name of your ISP's news server. And well, that was it. You were now on Usenet. The newsreader would show you a list of all the available news groups, of which there would be several thousand, but you could, of course, choose to subscribe to only a few of them, as in the screenshot here. You could select a group from this list of subscriptions to see all the recent articles that were posted to the news group, the same way you would select a folder in an email client. You could then read and reply to individual articles, or you could start your own thread. And your newsreader would then submit the message that you would compose to your news server, which would then propagate it back throughout the entire network. And somebody on the other side of the world with their own newsreader would be presented with the same screen, and your message would show up. The whole process seems very simple, but consider the implications of this simplicity. With no ulterior motive to get people onto Usenet, that is, with no advertisements, the people involved in Usenet were all working for the singular common goal of fostering public discussion. The programmers of Usenet server software and Usenet newsreaders, programmers who were themselves users of the system, focused on functionality and usability issues that were defined by real-world needs, not the profit motive of a central platform operator. Non-programming users, who had a free choice of newsreaders, gravitated to those that best served their own personal communication needs. Users would have quickly abandoned any newsreader that actively constrained or even sabotaged their freedom to discover, read, and contribute information, the way that today's social media platforms are actually designed to do. And it's clear that the users themselves understood the benefits of Usenet as a medium. Here's how one internet chronicler, Michael Halbin, writing in 1995, described his first experiences with Usenet. One professor's encouragement helped me to use Usenet and the internet as places to conduct research. My research was real participation in the online community by exploring how and why these communications forums functioned. I posed questions on Usenet, mailing lists, and freenets. Along with these questions, I would attach some worthwhile preliminary research. People respected my questions and found the preliminary research helpful. The entire process was one of mutual respect and sharing of research and ideas. A real notion of community and participation takes place. I found that on the net, people willingly help each other and work to define and address issues important to them. These are often important issues which the conventional media would never cover. And he later wrote, "Easy connection to people and ideas from around the world has a powerful effect. Awareness that we are members of the human species, which spans the entire globe, changes a person's point of view. It is a broadening perspective. It is very easy for people to assume a limited point of view if they are only exposed to certain ideas. The net brings the isolated individual into contact with other people, experiences, and views from the rest of the world. Exposure to many opinions gives the reader a chance to actually consider multiple views before settling on a specific opinion. Having access to the marketplace of ideas allows a person to make a reasoned judgment. Furthermore, users like Halbin understood that these benefits were due in large part to Usenet's decentralized and non-commercial nature. In 1993, Halbin wrote, "The net has only developed because of the hard work and voluntary dedication of many people. It has grown because the net is in the control and power of the people at the grassroots level, and because these people developed it. People's posts and contributions to the net have been the developing forces." And finally, much of the development of Usenet owes a big thanks to the early restrictions on commercial uses. Where else in our society has the commercial element been so clearly separated from any entity? Forums of discussion and communication become clogged and congested when advertisements use space. Because of the voluntary actions of those who use and redistribute net news and email, people on Usenet feel it is wrong to assist commercial ventures. When people feel someone is abusing the nature of Usenet, they let the offender know through email and in public messages. In this manner, users work to keep Usenet as a forum that is free from commercial exploitation. Usenet is not allowed to be abused as a profit-making venture for any one individual or group. Rather, people fight to keep it a resource that is helpful to society as a whole. So what happened between then and now? How did we get from the internet of the 1980s and 1990s, where the vast majority of public discourse was conducted on an open network designed and operated by and for its users, to today's world of centrally controlled, profit-driven social media that actively suppresses the transmission and diversification of ideas? And given that many of the millions of people on Usenet had actually foreseen the threats of commercialization and commodification, how and why did they allow this to happen? Well, unfortunately, this is the point of my talk where I need to depart from factual knowledge and venture into the realm of speculation. I don't really have any firm answer to these questions, though there are a couple of ideas that I'm hoping we might discuss. First, we might examine the economic forces at work. Socialists understand that in the course of history, capitalism triumphed over earlier forms of production, such as slavery and feudalism, because it was more efficient. It could be that similar material forces shaped the development of discussion technology. Usenet was developed largely by unpaid volunteers or by co-opted university staff and students. As I've already explained, this means that it was developed to meet those volunteers' own needs, but this also means that the system was improved as and when resources became available and without any particular targets or deadlines. By contrast, the people that created social media companies, having identified ways in which online communication could be exploited for commercial gain, were able to marshal a significant amount of human and technical resources into the rapid development of new technologies. This development quickly eclipsed the state of community-developed networks like Usenet, drawing new users in with certain new and genuinely helpful features, such as, say, support for images and audio-video posts, or better integration with mobile devices, but at the same time, adding additional features that were useful only to the platform's customer base of advertisers and market researchers, and sometimes even eventually removing or sabotaging the discussion-oriented features that users had come for the first place. Second, it could be that Usenet's socially conscientious user base was simply swamped by the huge influx of new users who got online for the first time in the late 1990s and early 2000s. Far more so than other parts of the internet, Usenet assimilated its users into a diverse but cohesive community, which was united through shared culture, shared values, and techno-social conventions. Users coming to Usenet for the first time in the 1980s and 1990s were warmly welcomed into this cooperative and largely commercial-free world. But it always took a bit of time, as well as the concerted efforts of the existing population, to acculturate these newcomers. Now, this wasn't a problem in the early decades of Usenet, before network access became commonplace. But the explosion of home internet connections in the 1990s meant that users started arriving faster than the resident netizens could show them what their new cooperative online world was all about. So with no one to guide them, these new users came to view the internet as a service rather than as a society. And they gravitated to platforms like Facebook that had the best financial and technical means to draw them in. So where do we go from here? Will online society ever abandon big societal media and return to the more egalitarian, more cooperative, by and for the people model that it enjoyed in decades past? Or are we destined to remain in the thrall of corporations like Facebook and Twitter, allowing them to commodify our personal data and our conversations in the name of profit? Well, I don't know, but there are two glimmers of hope. First, Usenet is still around today. And while it isn't as popular as it was in its heyday, its activity seems to have stabilized. And much of its essential maintenance work is still being carried out by a team of dedicated volunteers. So if people ever do push for a return to an open model, Usenet will still be there waiting to receive them, or at least to survive as a to serve as a slightly rusty but still working model upon which to base a newer technological system. Second, we are already seeing a similar trend being reversed in another area of computing, namely software. As those of you who may have attended my talk some 15 years ago know, the field of software development has witnessed a trajectory of open and cooperative development in the 1960s to a closed commercial development in the 1980s and 1990s, but then increasingly back to an open model in the last few decades. Personal and business users alike are discovering, or in some cases rediscovering, the value of cooperation and sharing when it comes to software development. And uptake of freely licensed and distributed packages such as GNU and Linux has been steadily increasing for some time now. Could this be the harbinger of a similar trend in online discussion technology? Of course, socialists have been telling people for well over a century now that society would function best if we produce things with a view to meeting people's needs rather than making a profit. And if the system of production were organized democratically, and if the means for distributing what is produced were owned and operated by the community at large. The netizens who founded and built up Usenet, what became the world's largest online community, seem to have figured this, all this out on their own, at least insofar as it applied to their own online network. It will be interesting to see whether any of them are willing and able to help repeat this feat for society at large. And with that, my talk is over, and I guess I'll hand it back to the chair.